Hi, this is Susan at the Talking Information Center. I'm reading the Dorchester Reporter. I'm reading and recording on Wednesday, July 8th, 2026. Greenway detour along Morrissey tied to flood control job. A section of the Neponset River Greenway next to Boston Bowl will remain closed all summer as state crews work on a new pump station aimed at reducing recurring flooding along Morrissey Boulevard, by the reporter staff. The Department of Conservation and Recreation said the closure, which began in mid-April, is part of the agency's $3.8 million Morrissey Boulevard Resilient Stormwater Pump Station project. The work zone is behind number 818 Morrissey, where the new underground station will connect to an existing stormwater outfall into the Neponset River. The project is intended to address a long-running flooding problem on Morrissey Boulevard, where heavy rain combined with high tides or storm surges can shut the outfall tide gate, preventing stormwater from draining into the river. When that happens, water can back up onto the boulevard and nearby properties, creating hazardous driving conditions. DCR says the permanent pump station will allow stormwater to keep moving out during those high tide events, significantly reducing local flooding. Greenway users are being routed around the impacted section while construction continues. DCR said the temporary closure is needed to allow stormwater bypass pumping and safe access for construction crews, even though the station itself is being built outside the trail footprint. The detour impacts the newest missing link section of the Neponset Greenway that opened to the public in July 2025. State and local officials held a formal ribbon cutting on April 29th, celebrating the 0.9-mile extension from Tenian Beach to Morrissey Boulevard. The work is part of a broader set of resiliency and transportation investments planned or underway in the area, including the Morrissey Boulevard and Kosciuszko Circle redesign, the Neponset River Greenway extension, the JFK UMass Station Access Plan, and Climate Ready Boston initiatives. DCR expects the project to be substantially complete in September, which would allow the affected Greenway path to reopen. Full project completion is expected in spring 2027. The agency said it completed earlier work within the bike path footprint during construction of the Greenway to limit future disruptions, but the current phase required additional design work and property easements before the pump station design could be finalized. Idea for Orange Line Spur draws mix of support, skepticism, forceful opposition, by Yawu Miller. City councilors Brian Worrell and Minyard Culpeppers called last week for a new subway line stretching from Ruggles Station to Mattapan Square has sparked debate over transit in Boston's black community, where many residents rely heavily on buses bogged in traffic for trips to work, school, and shopping. Reaction ranged from support from some within the communities around Blue Hill Ave to skepticism from Mayor Michelle Wu and other elected officials to outright opposition from transit advocates who have long supported the city's plan for a center-running bus lane on Blue Hill Avenue. While the advocates estimate that the proposed subway line would cost billions of dollars to build and could take decades for planning and the securing of federal funding, the idea itself has sparked a larger discussion about transit investment and needs in Mattapan, Dorchester, and Roxbury. It's opened the door for a conversation that needs to be had about a replacement for the elevated Orange Line, said transit activist Mila Miles. Miles hasn't taken a position on the city's plan for bus lanes, a plan for which city and state officials are confident they will receive federal funding to build out. That proposal, which has gone through a years-long community planning process, has faced pushback from business owners and some residents who fear the lane closures will cause congestion and hurt businesses on Blue Hill Avenue that rely on auto traffic. Culpepper, who has consistently opposed the plan for center-running bus lanes, said his opposition was part of the impetus for the Orange Line extension plan. "When you say no to something, you have to have an alternative," he said. Representative Brandy Fluker Reed, another elected leader who represents part of the Blue Hill Avenue corridor, highlighted the center-running bus lane in a social media post last month. Noting her participation in a ride along with MBTA officials, Fluker Reed said, "We simulated the 28 bus route up Blue Hill Ave, then experienced the center-running bus lane on Columbus Ave firsthand. Over 40,000 people ride through this corridor every weekday, most of them from Mattapan, Dorchester, and Roxbury. Decades of disinvestment have made that ride slower and harder than it should be. This redesign is about finally fixing that." She added, "This project is moving and our communities deserve to see it through." In a July 6 statement submitted to the reporter, Representative Fluker Reed clarified her position. "Whether on the bus, driving, or walking down Blue Hill Avenue, I am the Blue Hill Avenue transit community. Blue Hill Avenue cannot remain the same. It must create safer conditions, as well as a real plan to protect Black-owned businesses. My support has always been conditional on protecting our community's wealth and legacy businesses like Lawson's Barbershop, as well as newer community favorites like Cafe Juice. Research is clear that train infrastructure drives gentrification and displacement far more than bus service," she added. "Our community deserves a real plan that makes Blue Hill Ave safe and protects what makes this corridor ours." State Senator Liz Miranda, while not opposed to a new subway line, said that discussion about the Blue Hill Ave redesign should be separate from any subway conversation. "The proposed Orange Line extension should not be presented as an alternative to that work," she said in a statement sent to the reporter. "While it's an exciting long-term vision," she added, "it has never gone through a community planning process, has no identified funding source, and has not earned broad community buy-in. Even under the most optimistic timeline, this project could take 25 years to deliver, cost nearly $10 billion, and likely require the use of eminent domain to acquire private property along the corridor." As to the current Centerlane bus plan for Blue Hill Ave, Miranda said it does not have broad community support, so the city and MBTA need to go back to the community for a new look at the situation. "Without a new redesign process that earns broad community buy-in, I don't believe we should move forward with any proposal," she said. "I believe that approach gives us the best chance to deliver meaningful transportation improvements that the community can support and be proud of." When the state moved the Orange Line from Washington Street to the Southwest Corridor in 1987, the project widened the gap between the subway line and the Red Line, lengthening commutes for people in what was then and is now the heart of the city's Black community. Some 15 years before that project moved forward, then-Governor Frank Sargent gave Black community residents a verbal promise that the MBTA would provide a replacement service that was equal to or better than the elevated line. It wasn't until 2002 that the MBTA launched the Silver Line, an articulated bus that travels on Washington Street in restricted, side-running lanes that are shared with cyclists and often with double-parked cars. Critics panned the replacement service, referring to it as the 49 bus painted gray. "When they promised us comparable rail service, we really believed they would do it," Culpepper said. "We got the Silver Line, which is a joke." In the intervening years, the MBTA invested heavily in rail outside of Boston, extending the Red Line from Harvard Square to Alewife Station in 1985 and completing the extension of the Green Line from Lechmere to Somerville and Medford in 2022. While Mayor Wu did not voice opposition to Culpeper and Worrell's plan, she told reporters their plan could cost billions of dollars and take decades to complete. "Extending the Orange Line from Forest Hills to Rosendale, the neighborhood where Wu lives, actually would be pretty, relatively speaking, cost-effective." Wu told the reporter John Keller, noting that such an extension could follow an existing commuter rail and Amtrak right-of-way. Worrell said officials' apparent resistance to the plan underscores a double standard. "It just speaks to how government has disinvested from our neighborhood for so long," he said. "We feel like subway infrastructure that's been around since the 1800s is too much for us." Jeffrey Rosenblum, co-founder and board chair of the group Livable Streets, has long advocated for bus rapid transit that incorporates center-running bus lanes. He, too, cautioned that a new subway line could take years to implement, but said Culpepper and Worrell are right to raise the idea. Long-term visioning is critical, he said. We've been trained as a society to never think big and never think ahead. While Rosenblum says rail projects should be a critical component of the state's planning to meet transit and climate goals, he acknowledges that the funding isn't there to embark on such projects at the current moment. There is no reason we cannot do bus rapid transit now and think about the future, he said. For Mattapan and Dorchester residents looking for a faster ride downtown, the Fairmont Line electrification project has been a ray of hope. Local transit activists have for years advocated for local service on the commuter rail line that until recently ran from Hyde Park to South Station with no stops in between. A new Mattapan station at Blue Hill Ave opened in 2019, along with stops at Talbot Ave, Geneva Ave, Dudley Street, and South Bay. The line has all the fixings of a rapid transit line, minus the rapidity. MBTA officials promises to electrify the route, bringing frequency up from a train every half hour to one every 20 minutes, have not yet materialized. In 2024, T officials announced electric cars would be in service in 2028. Last week, they pushed the date back to 2030. At the Boston Home, customized repairs on wheelchairs support mobility and dignity. By Shang-O Yoon, special to the reporter. Jody Gold, who uses a power wheelchair, doesn't drive it with her hands. She drives it with her head. Gold, a resident at the Boston Home on Dorchester Avenue since 2017, has multiple sclerosis and is unable to walk or use her hands. Her customized chair is equipped with a set of small controls positioned around her head that allow her to steer it with slight movements. With the controls in place, she can go downstairs for coffee, use her iPad, attend activities, and get to where she wants to go next. I can do everything with this chair, the 68-year-old Gold said. It's like my legs. Given that, when it breaks down, the loss to her is more than a slight inconvenience, and that is when the Boston Homes Wheelchair Enhancement Center steps in to keep her chair and those of others making repairs quickly in-house. Led by Assistive Technology Coordinator Corinne Curran of Dorchester, the center handles repairs, custom adaptations, and makes small inventions that make a difference to the 96 people who live in the long-term care residence, most of whom have advanced MS and other progressive neurological disorders. Curran said the center has been around longer than she has worked there, but its purpose has evolved with advances in wheelchairs and assistive technology. The goal, she said, is to help residents remain independent when available equipment does not satisfy their needs. There are many things that are just not commercially available that need to be custom made for our residents to be able to do that, she said. It's not even necessarily a cost thing. It just doesn't exist. The work can be as simple as replacing a worn joystick topper at their innovative 3D printer lab. For residents who use their hands to drive, a topper can make a big difference. But one commercially available dome joystick topper costs $97, Curran said. The center can make a 3D printed temporary version for 37 cents in materials. When one wears out, Curran said, a wheelchair company might send someone out weeks later to assess the problem, then submit a quote to insurance before a replacement arrives. In the meantime, the center prints a temporary part so the resident can keep using the chair. With 3D printing, Curran said, the center can also test designs repeatedly until they fit a resident who may need a specific shape because of limited hand movement. Others may need phone holders placed where they can reach them. A small part may go through several design variations before it is right. Other adaptations are made from repurposed parts. Curran showed how old wheelchair headrest hardware can be used to build iPad mounts. She also demonstrated an adjustable cup holder made from a microphone stand, an old wheelchair wheel, casters, PVC pipe, and 3D printed pieces. For Gold, having a cup holder means she can drink coffee, wine, or another beverage at her own pace. If someone else is holding the drink, a resident may feel rushed, especially when staff members are helping several people at once. For residents with MS, drinking too quickly can cause health risks, including aspiration and pneumonia, Karen said. For somebody like Jody, it's some dignity, Karen said. She's an adult human being. The center works closely with the rehabilitation team before adding or changing parts on a chair. A device has to be safe and not interfere with therapy or positioning. Victoria Stevens, the home's director of communications, said properly fitted power chairs are important not only for mobility but also for health. Residents who cannot reposition themselves are at risk for pain and pressure sores, Stevens said. Power chairs can tilt, recline, and support residents in ways that standard manual chairs often cannot. Living life with mobility, she said, also supports mental health, social life, and cognitive engagement. The physical and the medical are really entwined, Stevens said. Being able to maintain your independence also really helps to maintain your cognitive ability. Before coming to the Boston home, Gold said she spent much of her time at a different facility isolated in her room. Some days she stayed in bed. Other days she sat in a chair and watched the game show network. The change after moving to the Boston home, she said, was night and day. Now, after staff help her into her chair with a Hoyer lift, an assistive device used to transfer residents from their beds to their wheelchairs, Gold can move through the building, join activities, and even take part in an online book club with friends from outside. With voice control accessibility features on her iPad, she can read, listen to audiobooks, and watch shows. Gold's chair is also part of her life outside the Boston home. Karen said some adaptations are designed with family outings in mind, including a slimmer phone mount that Gold can use when family takes her out. Karen also considers how changes to the chair will work with her family's van. Ensuring that the equipment helps her move through the facility can also support her life beyond it. For other residents, power chairs can provide them with a lifestyle. Karen said some residents drive down Dorchester Avenue to get coffee at Dunkin' or go out for community events, including Dorchester Day celebrations. Residents who want to leave the campus independently go through a rehabilitation evaluation to make sure they can safely navigate traffic, curbs, and street crossings. Others can take part in staff-supported outings. Gold said she turned down the chance to move to the Boston home twice because she did not like change. The third time, a few months before her daughter's wedding, she and her husband decided to give it a go. She said she has never looked back. Before I was here, I was existing, Gold said, and here I am living. Karen and the wheelchair repair shop will make sure her life continues to move on, no matter what cog enters the wheel. St. John Paul II Catholic Academy graduates 53 on its three campuses. St. John Paul II Catholic Academy celebrated the graduation of 53 students from its Columbia Road, Lower Mills, and Neponset campuses during a June 4th commencement ceremony at BC High's McNeese Pavilion. The class of 2026 was led by three valedictorians, Avada Schneider of the Columbia Road campus, Isaiah Magali of the Lower Mills campus, and Alana Trong of the Neponset campus. Danny Cueva, a Lower Mills campus alumni from the class of 2009, delivered the keynote address. Cueva, who began at the academy as a K-2 student and later served as class president, went on to graduate from Boston College High School in 2013 and then earned degrees from Boston College and the University of Liverpool. He now works in the Boston area as operations manager at Cara Group Travel. He told the graduates that he saw something familiar in their faces. "I look out at each of you and see myself," he said. "While our passions may be different and our paths most certainly are, we come from a common foundation." Cueva spoke about growing up in Dorchester near Ashmont Station as the son of immigrants from Honduras and El Salvador and credited his family's sacrifice and work ethic with giving him the support and guidance that shaped his life. "This is the same foundation of values that SJP Academy built on, instilling the importance of gratitude, mindfulness, and community within its students," he said. The ceremony also included several campus awards. The St. Bridget of Kildare Award, honoring the legacy of the religious sisters who opened and staffed Catholic schools in the Archdiocese of Boston, was presented to Yawilka Tejeda of Columbia Road, Eliana Taylor Young of Laura Mills, and Faith Green of Neponset. The St. Patrick Award, given to young men who have grown in integrity, character, and love of God, went to Ethan Smith of Columbia Road, David Obas of Lower Mills, and Chinedu Ikwanusi of Neponset. The Our Lady of Guadalupe Award, recognizing unconditional love, inclusivity, respect, and perseverance, was presented to Alani de Miranda of Columbia Road, Jalexa Fernandez of Flora Mills, and Juan Vasquez of Neponset. The St. Quisido Award, given to students who exemplify strong values and faith, service to others, and commitment to God, went to Diego Fonseca Cruz of Columbia Road, Stephen Peavy of Lower Mills, and Philip Emmanuel Perez of Neponset. The Spirit of St. John Paul II Award, selected by peers for students who foster respect and demonstrate peace, love, and patience, was presented to Margarita Centeo of Columbia Road, Xavier Jonathus of Lower Mills, and Nora Forey of Neponset. The graduating class included 13 students from Columbia Road, 22 from Lower Mills, and 18 from Neponset. Dot History Garden is moving toward design plan. Plans to establish a Dorchester History Garden on an underutilized park on Columbia Road are advancing this summer, according to organizers who convened more than a dozen neighbors and stakeholders on Monday at the proposed site, which includes the historic Blake House and an oddly placed statue of the mid-19th century statesman Edward Everett. On hand were John McColgan of the Pear Square Collaborative, city archaeologist Joe Bagley, and Dorchester Historical Society President Earl Taylor, along with neighbors and architectural students and representatives from the Hideo Sasaki Foundation, who discussed a pre-design report they will produce this summer. Sasaki produced a conceptual design last year via a state earmark secured by State Senator Nick Collins that suggested designs and themes for a history garden. The ongoing visioning process is being run by Stephanie Benitez with oversight from others at Sasaki. McColgan, a Dorchester resident and retired City of Boston archivist, welcomed everyone in front of the Blake House, the oldest standing home in Boston. "My idea," he said, "was to make this place a cultural asset that would provide an opportunity to highlight all of the cultures and groups that call Dorchester home." Collaborative board member and neighbor Michael Kearney noted that the site, known as Richardson Park, already has a history theme with the Blake House and the Clap Pear sculpture positioned at Edward Everett Square. "I have an interest in seeing this park used to the best of its ability," he said. "I think it's underutilized by the public, and if redesigned, could become used a lot more beneficially." For her part, Annapolis Street resident Isaac Resendez has high hopes. "I think it would be exciting to think of the possibilities, but now it's up in the air, so it's hard to have strong feelings about it as it currently stands," said Resendez, who attended the Russell Elementary School across the street and often walked through the park as a kid. "However, the history of this neighborhood is fascinating, and anything we can do to preserve and honor it gets my vote." The walk featured stops at the open field hill next to the Blake House, where generations of families have sledded in the snow and children have played baseball and other games, while also serving as an important cut-through pathway for pedestrians. Neighbors suggested the area should remain open, but perhaps used for performances and art fairs, as once happened on the site. Bagley noted that it was the first Dorchester town green and that an important native and colonial freshwater asset known as Great Pond existed adjacent to it. It was filled in when the Blake House was moved to that location in 1895. "Having freshwater so near the ocean would have been a big deal," he said. Bagley also plans to study relocating the historic Capon House on the site permanently. Other spots on the tour included highlighting the fruit trees planted behind the Blake House that attest to the area's agricultural heritage, including the development of the innovative Clapp's favorite pear in the immediate area during the 1800s. While current pear trees that were planted are thriving, neighbors said they would like to see more of those laid out like an orchard, with the history spelled out prominently. Most at the gathering said a focal point should be the statue of Everett, who served as U.S. Secretary of State and delivered an oration ahead of President Abraham Lincoln at the dedication of the National Cemetery in Gettysburg in November 1863. The site around the statue is surrounded by a fence and unsightly with weeds and trash strewn around it. Overgrown apple trees obscure the statue, and neighbors complain they provide cover for illicit drug use and unhoused people. Most residents felt the statue should be moved to the apex of the park so that Everett's image could be easily seen and his history better explained. Seamus Highland, a St. Mark's resident and member of the Union Club that counts Everett and his descendants as members, said he would like to connect the club to the History Garden project. He also noted that sound mitigation would be a key improvement. "Until now, I didn't realize how loud it is in here," he said, as an ambulance and a large dump truck drowned out the discussion. "It would be nice to have some kind of noise mitigation in any new park." There was also agreement that some sort of cultural highlight, maybe even an immigration timeline with robust histories of Dorchester immigrant groups, could be part of a walking pathway around the park. That could include Native American populations, early colonial settlers, and immigrant communities from Ireland, Poland, Vietnam, Haiti, Cape Verde, Germany, Spanish-speaking countries, and others. That was McColgan's initial concept, and it seemed to carry interest on Monday. Key hurdles remain, though, as ownership of the park is in dispute between the state and the city, neither of which seem to want it. Senator Collins mentioned there is an effort afoot in the legislature to transfer ownership of the park to the Dorchester Historical Society, which already owns the adjacent Blake House. Benitez said that students will be taking input gathered Monday to inform a midsummer presentation on July 22nd at 10 a.m. with the location to be determined. A final presentation will be made Thursday, August 11th at 1 p.m. with the location to be determined. If all goes well this week, the Capon House that was once located across the street from the Dorchester Courthouse will again be in Boston courtesy of city archaeologist Joe Bagley, who'd like someday to return it to Dorchester. After an interesting journey within the city procurement process, Bagley said he expects to purchase the historic building from a collector in Wisconsin who has the home stored in pieces at a warehouse in Ipswich. It would be the second oldest home in Boston from 1675, behind the Blake House from 1661, and Bagley is taking the temperature on locating it next to the Blake House. "We didn't realize what we were buying when we proposed to get it," he said. "We didn't realize how incredibly intact it was. The big question is, where does it go? We want to give it back to Dorchester eventually." Thanks for listening to the Dorchester Reporter on Wednesday, July 8th, from the Talking Information Center.